This is really a public question time, but I always like to warm things up by answering one question at the beginning, a hypothetical question, as if somebody had asked me while I'm getting ready for this, as if somebody had asked me what happened to the dinosaurs, and what about the dinosaurs? Do they fit into the Bible history? And one of the reasons why people ask about dinosaurs is because they have all of these evolutionary ideas that come along with them. For example, an age of dinosaurs millions of years ago, or a world before time, or a lost world, or a world that was so radically different from the world of today, and the idea that dinosaurs never lived alongside of people, and so on. Because most people realize that from a long ages point of view, whether they're evolutionists or not, even the Flintstones are intolerable, because the absolute total belief is that the last dinosaur died out at least 65 million years before the first person appeared on Earth. Once again, instead of trying to fit dinosaurs into the Bible, we can explain dinosaurs using biblical glasses. For example, if I said to you, and I'll just try this quickly, hands up those of you who believe that the dinosaurs, who believe that the Bible gives us definite information as to when God created Tyrannosaurus Rex. Hands up. I'm glad to see some hands are up, because the Bible does actually, indirectly, because it says in Exodus 20:11, one of the Ten Commandments, "For in 6 days the Lord your God created the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that in them is." Doesn't say created everything but not the dinosaurs, which means dinosaurs were also created in those 6 days. And I didn't mention the fact that as far as top Hebrew professors are concerned, there is no argument as to what Genesis was written to convey, what the Hebrew can only mean. And I'm talking about professors who are mostly unbelievers. They don't believe that Genesis is actually true. But they say, and I'll quote from one of them, his name is Professor James Barr. He's Regis, thank you, Professor of Hebrew and Old Testament at Oxford University. He was when he made this comment. And he said it was not only him, but so far as I know, he said, there is no professor of Hebrew or Old Testament at any world-class university. He's talking about Princeton, Cambridge, Yale, Harvard, who doesn't believe that whoever wrote Genesis 1-11 meant to tell their readers that creation was in 6 earth rotation days, that there was no gap, that everything started from the beginning of those days, and at the end of those days we can count from that point onwards, we can count the chronologies, and it was meant to tell us that something happened, all of that happened very recently, in a few thousand years, and that the flood covered the whole world and wiped out everything except it was inside the ark. Words to that effect. In other words, to defend that theologically is like shooting fish in a barrel. And the reason why people say, but, it can't mean this or it can't mean that, is not for biblical reasons. It's because of this enormous pressure of science, and it's because they're interpreting everything through these evolutionary glasses. So let's say, okay, if dinosaurs were created on the same day as people, because dinosaurs were land animals, and land animals were created on day 6. Many people think, I've seen dinosaurs swimming, and I've seen dinosaurs flying, but no, they're not actually dinosaurs. They're marine reptiles or flying reptiles. Dinosaurs has a technical meaning. It has to do with the fenestrations, the holes in their skull, and those things were not dinosaurs. T-Rex was a land animal. So if people and dinosaurs once upon a time knew each other, then you would expect to have some cultural memories of a time when people once lived with some of these creatures, which, you know, many of them were unimpressive, but some of them were huge, impressive, horns, scales, armor plating, big teeth, those sorts of things. And of course there are stories like that in just about every culture around the world. You know, dragon images have been found on the Ishtar Gate of Babylon, on Aztec temples, cliffs above the Mississippi River, the prows of Viking ships, bones carved by Inuit. Australian Aborigines have stories of reptilian-type monsters. There's the flag of Wales has a dragon as its national symbol. the Chinese year, you know, the year of the monkey and the ox and the pig and all that. They're all real animals, and except there's one. Which one is it? Year of the dragon. And suddenly we're told that's a mythical one. Why? It's just not consistent. The ancient Chinese emperors wrote of actually taming some of these creatures to draw their carriages and some smaller ones. And they also knew that dinosaurs laid eggs. It's not difficult to see that many of the dragons of legend were probably the remains of the stories from telling and retelling stories change of the dinosaurs of history. You know, you've probably heard of this man, he's Marco Polo. And, you know, Italians think they invented pasta and noodles, but actually they didn't. The Chinese invented noodles, I'm sure most of you knew that. But he was the guy that took the noodles to Italy. So they think they invented the pasta. But anyway, he was an intrepid explorer, very well known. And he also described dragons. He called them serpents with, you know, eyes as large as loaves of bread and all, you know, very dramatic accounts. And there are accounts of Alexander the Great, his soldiers being frightened by, you know, very large serpentine creatures in India and so on. But stories at the end of the day are stories. What would be really impressive is if we had some drawings. And in actual fact that there are drawings that go far back. For instance, this drawing, it's a brass engraving, and it's found on the tomb of Bishop Bell, who died in the 1400s, and you find that in the floor of Carlisle Cathedral in the United Kingdom. And the cathedral and this grave, they all go back to the 1400s, long before they had dinosaur books. You know, no one would have had a clue how to, even if they stumbled across a dinosaur bone, wouldn't have had a clue how to reconstruct a creature like this. And here's another part of the same drawing. And so if they're not trying to depict dinosaurs, I don't know what they're trying to depict, and where would they have seen them, if not from life. Here you have a cylinder seal from ancient Mesopotamia. And this creature at first glance doesn't look very dinosaurian, but here's a reconstruction of Tanystropheus, one of the extinct dinosaur types. Looks very much like that. And the interesting thing is that if you say, well, maybe it's just some stylized representation, but exactly the same thing is found in ancient Egypt on a pottery vase from totally separated cultures and separated by, you know, many, many centuries. And, you know, people say, well, is there anything more? The ruins of Angkor Wat. I'm sure some of you have actually seen them. Anybody been to Cambodia and seen those ruins? Anybody seen the film Lara Croft Tomb Raider? No, don't confess to that. But the apparently, I haven't even seen it for research purposes, but apparently the temple ruins of Angkor Wat were part of the film setting. I say that because you can see these ruins are so ancient that they've got these huge tree roots and covering them. The jungle is encroaching on them. Everybody thinks these ruins are about 1,000 years old. They're certainly a lot older than when there were dinosaur books. And there are many carved animals, but here's one that I think you can even tell me what sort of dinosaur. Can you? Stegosaurus, you know. Where would they draw that if not from life? If you saw how those things appeared in the record and how many, you know, generations of scientific endeavor were involved in working out how it actually came together, then you'd realize that that's quite astonishing. You know, people sometimes say, well, how come the Bible doesn't mention dinosaurs? Well, people don't get too excited about the fact that the Bible doesn't mention kangaroos either. But as a matter of fact, I think the Bible probably does mention dinosaurs. It doesn't call them dinosaurs, and there's a reason for that. You see, if you've got one of those Bible search program and you type the word dinosaur in, it won't come up. But the reason is exactly the same reason that you won't find the word email or locomotive or computer, because all of those words were invented in the English language after the Bible was translated into English. The Bible was translated in 1611, the King James, and the word dinosaur was actually coined, invented, in the 1800s by Sir Richard Owen. What would they have called them back in those days in the King James day? You look up the word dragon or dragons and suddenly things pop up all over the place. Now sometimes you get, it's a symbolic reference, just as Satan is called the serpent or that old dragon. But of course, when you have a symbol, you know, you refer to something or someone as a serpent, that's because there are real serpents. And other parts of the Bible, dragon or dragons is used, it's the Hebrew word tanim, to mean a real creature. And it doesn't mean that the Hebrew word tanim always means dinosaur. Just like in the Bible, flying creatures involves birds, bats, things that are biologically classified differently. In Genesis, in the King James, it translates the word tanim as the whales were created. So the whales are the tanim of the sea. But tanim in other instances literally means like, you know, big, impressive creature. And so it's very likely that the Bible is referring to dinosaurs on at least some of those occasions. Certainly, there's a creature in the book of Job which is really mysterious, and that's Behemoth in Job chapter 40 verse 15. If it's not talking about a dinosaur, it's God speaking out of the whirlwind to Job, and he's referring in this majestic poetic language, he's referring to all of the wonderful things that God has done compared to what Job was able to achieve. You know, can you do this? Were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Can you make this happen? And then he says, behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. You know, he eateth grass like an ox, his force is in the muscles of his belly, his bones are like big bars of iron, I'm paraphrasing here, drinks up a river in one gulp, and he's the chief of God's ways. You know, so he's the mightiest vegetarian, grass-eating animal that God ever made. And the poor old commentators must have scratched their heads thinking, what creature is this? So some of them said, this is the elephant. And some said, it was a hippo. But in that chapter, in that passage, it actually says, he moveth his tail like a cedar tree. Now, I've seen the thick trunk of a cedar tree, and I've seen an elephant's tail. It's just a little thing like this, you know, sort of. It doesn't remind me of a cedar tree unless it's a bonsai cedar tree. But if that's... The sad thing is, you know, that word behemoth, it comes from the Hebrew word behemah, which means beast, and it sort of means beast of beasts. And in the Indonesian Bible, it's translated as kuda nil, which means Nile horse or hippopotamus, but that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says behemoth. And so, you know, if you open your mind to extinct creatures, then something like the Apatosaurus, one of those big sauropod dinosaurs, really was the largest land-dwelling, grass-eating animal that God ever made. And so that people think of that and they say, well, hang on a minute, Job was written in the land of Uz, yes. Uz was a descendant of Shem, yes. Shem was on the ark with Noah. Are you telling me the dinosaurs survived the flood? Well, of course, because it said in the Bible, too, of every kind, it didn't say leave behind the dinosaurs. And that, of course, raises a problem for some people because they say, well, you know, some of the dinosaurs were very impressive in size. Now, let me get this in perspective for a start. Many dinosaurs were quite small and quite cute, perhaps. In fact, if they'd survived today, because some of them were fully grown the size of a chicken, we might have had KFD instead of KFC. But there were some very, very big ones. I mean, how do you get one of those, that's just the one limb, through the door of the ark, let alone two? But of course, you know, God would have known something that's only been obvious the last few decades, and that is that we've all known that dinosaurs lay eggs like birds lay eggs, and with birds you have this instinctive understanding that the bigger the bird, the bigger the egg. So you've got this little quail's egg, and then chicken egg, and duck egg, and goose egg, and emu egg, and ostrich egg, and the extinct elephant bird had an egg like this. So people sort of thought something like that must have laid an egg the size of a house, or maybe a tool shed at least. But we know that's not the case, because there's a size limit. Because as the egg gets bigger, it gets heavier, and so the shell has to get massively thicker, and it reaches a point at which, otherwise it'll fall apart, at which the little dinosaur can't breathe anymore. So the size limit is such that all of the, even the very biggest dinosaurs, started life from an egg no bigger than a football. Now, I'm not saying that, or a little bit bigger. Now, I'm not saying that Noah took eggs on the ark, but what it means is that even the biggest animals were once itty-bitty baby dinosaurs, which became children dinosaurs, which means why should God send Big Mum and Dad on board if a couple of teenagers would have done the job just fine? And in fact, they've recently done some research on the microscopy of dinosaur bone, fossil bone, and they've concluded that dinosaurs, unlike many other creatures, had what they call an adolescent growth spurt, which means that as they were sort of reaching their, just before their sexual maturity, they would suddenly zoom up to very quickly reach their full size. So that would have been, just before then, would have been an ideal time for God to choose to send them on the ark, because remember, it wasn't Noah lassoing them and chasing them around, it was a supernatural, straightforward miracle. By the way, here's a photograph of an actual fossil of a dinosaur embryo in the egg. It's a fantastic fossil. And of course people ask, well, what happened to the dinosaurs? And here's an important point, I think, and that is that nobody asks us what happened to the left-footed Mongolian duck or something, because it also went extinct. It's always dinosaurs, and there's a reason for that, because a long ager is under pressure to come up with a big picture explanation, because in their interpretation of the fossil record, they believe in an age of dinosaurs followed by an age of no dinosaurs, so the obvious question is, hey, what happened? But from a biblical history perspective, you've got creation of a good world, ruined by sin, so dying, they started to die, and then there's diseases and climate change, you know, heard that before? I think I have, yeah. And lots and lots of things happening, and competition and struggle for survival. And so it's no big deal in that sense. It's tragic, of course, but it's nothing unusual for species to die out. In fact, species have been dying out since the fall, and in fact, in my own lifetime, over 400 significant species went extinct. Now, there's a little bit of a difference, because a lot of the species extinction in our day comes from the action of people, habitat destruction or overhunting. For example, many people don't realize that Australia once had a megafauna. We have the bones, and these are fairly recent bones. They've been described and drawn on Aboriginal rock art. And you've got giant emu, you've got a giant kangaroo, you've got a giant wombat, and so on, and giant kangaroo. And yet they're all extinct. And this extinction is mostly, by most authorities, blamed on humans overhunting. Now, I'm not blaming the hunter, because it makes sense to get the biggest feed for the family if you're going out to kill something, but nobody would allow that to be, no evolutionist would allow that to be an explanation for some of the dinosaur extinctions. But if you do allow, in a biblical history perspective, for human activity, a lot of things become possible. For example, many of you know that on the Australian flag in one corner we've got the Union Jack that consists of three crosses, which is the crosses of England, Scotland and Wales, and the cross, the flag of England is the cross of St. George. Now St. George became a hero for killing a dragon in some lonely cave. Now perhaps he wasn't a hero after all, perhaps he was a conservationist's worst nightmare, knocking off the last of its kind, who knows. But can you see why it is that there's always been these big picture explanations? You see, today, the most popular explanation, particularly in the popular press, is that they died from some massive bombardment from outer space. Interestingly, a lot of people don't realize that most of the academics have actually walked away from that explanation. There's been all sorts of problems with it discovered, and I won't go into that, but there's been articles in our technical journal, which is called the Journal of Creation. We also publish a peer-reviewed journal as a service to the community of scientists who are into biblical creation. And before that was popular, there was another theory, and it was so popular it was discussed in the scientific literature, and it made it into the coffee table books even. And that was that the dinosaurs must have been, the herbivores among them must have been used to eating this group of plants that is now extinct. And so the theory was that these plants had a high natural fiber or roughage content, and so the dinosaurs died of chronic constipation. And so And there's been more. I mean, I like to think I prefer Gary Larson's theory of why the dinosaurs died out. And I challenge you to disprove it. And there's been others. There's been theories of plants having natural narcotic properties, and so the dinosaurs got hooked on all this stuff and so on. But seriously now, if you'd been getting our material, even our email newsletter, if there was such a thing in 1990s, because there wasn't from us, but our Creation magazine had a story of the sensational discovery of red blood cells in dinosaur bones. The evolutionist who discovered them, Dr. Mary Schweitzer, she said that it was exactly like looking at a slice of modern bone. But of course I couldn't believe it. I said to the lab technician, the bones after all are 65 million years old. How could blood cells survive that long? You notice how she went about it. Instead of saying, well, they look like blood cells. If they are, well, let's look into it. Maybe they're not that old at all. No, the article of faith is that they're millions of years old. And everything else bows to that. Do you know there was some argument for years as to whether these really were blood cells, even though they had immunological evidence of hemoglobin from washings taken from those fossils. They would inject them into rats and the rats would develop antibodies to hemoglobin, but control rats wouldn't. But all of those doubts were laid to rest, and there's absolutely no doubt now, because there was the sensational discovery, even more sensational, a few years later, of soft tissue in T-Rex bones. That is, flexible and resilient ligaments, when stretched, return to their original shape. Not only that, but transparent blood vessels with branching, and inside them was this gunk that you could squeeze out. And when you did, and you put it under the microscope, here were these nucleated red blood cells, and they've since identified, without any doubt, the proteins collagen, osteocalcin, and another one whose name I've forgotten. It's a paradigm shift. They're now saying, yep, there's no doubt, because they're finding it in fossil after fossil where they're looking. Now, don't get me wrong, you have to dissolve the fossil. It's like when you take a chicken bone, a fresh one, and you dissolve it in a weak acid like vinegar. Good experiment to do with your kids. It dissolves the mineral in the bone, and what's left behind is the protein, the soft and stretchy stuff. But who would have thought that when you did that to a fossil dinosaur bone, you get the same thing? And all sorts of amazing things have now come out. They find that many fossils, they just didn't bother looking for these things, have actually got this soft tissue. And in Montana, where there's a lot of dinosaur fossils, there's one place that fossil hunters have known of for years, and it's called Hell's Creek. And the trade secret, if you like, that no one was game to talk about because it didn't make any sense, was that whenever you smashed open the rocks of Hell's Creek, there was this smell of rotting flesh. How can that be if these things are 65 million years old? But now, of course, we know why. This is what Schweitzer said about when she first discovered this. She said, as it dissolved, transparent vessels were left behind. It was totally shocking. I didn't believe it until we'd done it 17 times. You know, the amazing thing is now that it's accepted, instead of challenging the millions of years, people are saying, well, I guess we didn't know how long these things could last. You see, proteins like osteocalcin and collagen, they are complex molecules that even if you protected them from all radiation, from temperature, from bacteria, from moisture, from cosmic rays even, they would still in time fall apart because of the laws of thermodynamics. You see, they're still vibrating. The molecules are moving. It's called Brownian motion. And you can actually calculate their fall-apart times. And those calculations point to dates much younger than the alleged date of these fossils, you know, millions of years younger. But instead of saying, well, you know, I guess that shows that these aren't as old, it's now, well, they must be millions of years old, therefore our calculations have got some unknown factor. Now, that's not totally unreasonable. What I'm saying is that if you understand how a mindset works in science, I'm not talking human conspiracy. Obviously there are spiritual issues, but it's not that they're, you know, consciously lying or anything like this. They definitely passionately believe these things. But when people say to you, how could all those scientists be wrong? then keep that in mind, that it's like a monolith, it's like a paradigm of thought. It helps you to explain why it is that when anesthesia was introduced into medicine, most professors mocked and scoffed at the idea that you could make somebody have an operation without feeling any pain. When the idea came out that doctors and medical students should and nurses should wash their hands after dissecting pussy corpses before they delivered babies, the guy that thought of that and proved it experimentally was laughed and mocked and hounded out of academia, and actually, you know, died in severe depression because of that rejection. In other words, the majority have a track record of getting it wrong a lot of the time. And here, what we're talking about is the Word of God. Okay, now that's dealt with dinosaurs, I think. Who wants to ask the first? Oh, I've got them all here. Sorry. Okay. Now, where someone has put two questions on the sheet, I'll take one, then I'll go back to it later on. What happened to the insects? Were they on Noah's Ark or were they wide out? I'm not sure what wide out means, but were they on the Ark? I think probably not, because it says there, as I said before, creatures whose breath is in their nostrils, and only vertebrates have nostrils, and insects are invertebrates and don't breathe through nostrils, and it would be very easy for them to survive outside the ark because they could just cluster on floating logs. They could survive, some of them, inside floating carcasses. Many insects survive for long periods of time on updrafts in the upper atmosphere. It's full of bugs up there, and so they probably weren't. But even if they were, even if there were, you know, a million types of insects that needed to be on the ark, they don't take up much space. Just give them a matchbox each, and that's fine. In the dog scenario, there are a few assumptions. The organism is and surviving our environment, when in real life it can survive in different environments and they can be subject to different selective pressures. Assuming that genes are co-dominant, but they can be recessive or polygenic. I think this person has got a few terms mixed up, but they've got a general idea. Look, no question that that was a simplified example, but they were it was making a clear point, and that was, and if you actually complexify the example, you don't solve the problem. The point was that you can have a variation in a population based upon the genes that are already there. And every single one, and I say this unequivocally, as I've had debates in public with evolutionary academics, and there's one out there on DVD, every one of the examples of evolution happening in textbooks is an example of natural selection causing adaptation based upon the existing information. Darwin's finches are a classic example. The beaks get longer in response to wet or dry seasons, and shorter in response to the opposite, because the types of seeds are different. So the birds that can, you know, pick the smaller seeds, they have an advantage in this type of weather and that. But that's adaptation based upon the genes that are already there. There's no new information. And in fact, on our film, a documentary, The Voyage That Shook the World, we show through interviews with evolutionists how the beaks are just cycling back and forth. They go long, they go short. They go long, they go short. It happens very quickly, and it flips back again the minute the environment changes back. The point that's being made is that no new information is added in any of those examples. To have new information, you would need to have a mutation providing that information. Now, mutations can sometimes be beneficial. For example, a beetle on a windy island can have a mutation whereby all of its offspring no longer able to produce wings. Now, that's almost certainly what did happen, because all of the beetles on Windy Islands, they have no wings, and you can see the little scars where their ancestors' wings used to be, same with blind fish in caves. But that's an example of a downhill change, because the reason why this defect, this corruption of wing information, is a positive is because on a windy island, if you can fly, you're blown into the sea and you drown. These are examples of downhill change. They're adaptation, but they're not examples of anything new, of new information. And that was the challenge that Dawkins was unable to answer. But there's much more detail on that given in the Creation Answers book. And if you've got a problem with some of those terms, I'll try and explain that to you, including some of the terms. Did it rain before the flood? Yes, I believe definitely. And people say, but what about the passage in Genesis where it said God had not yet caused it to rain upon the earth? Well, yeah, but it didn't say, and that condition lasted for 1600 years till the flood. It actually talks about that as a period of time before there was a man to till the earth. That was a time before God had created people. And the idea that, I mean, the Bible doesn't say that it did rain, doesn't talk about rain, but rain is something that happens when water is evaporated and you get clouds forming. And those clouds drift around, even if there aren't major wind movements, eventually those clouds will drop their load. So it's not really realistic to think that there was never any rain before the flood. And some say, well, what about the rainbow? How could there be, you know, rainbow for the first time? Well, the Bible doesn't actually say that the rainbow was there for the first time. God made it a sign of his covenant. You know, God has a habit, actually, of taking existing things and making them a sign of his covenant. For example, circumcision. Almost certainly, Abraham was not the first group of people to practice circumcision, but God made that a sign of his covenant. Same with the bread and the wine, and the Lord Jesus made those a sign of his covenant. So, you know, I wouldn't make that a point of fellowship or disfellowship, but let me say that we don't have to believe in six impossible things before breakfast, like that, you know, water could evaporate and it never came down again for 1600 years. Did asteroids or meteorites really wipe out the dinosaurs? I think I've probably answered that I certainly don't believe they did. Let me just say that some of the problems that have come up with that theory, that there's a crater on the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico that they used to believe was the smoking gun evidence of the impact that killed the dinosaurs. The problem was that even under their own dating systems, it was 300,000 years out of date. And in fact, some evolutionary geologists have even challenged that it's a crater at all. The most common belief these days is that it was some sort of massive volcanic outpouring that caused the atmosphere to be very toxic. But that doesn't explain how come only the dinosaurs died and so many other creatures living with the dinosaurs were spared. And of course, when you see a typical picture of with dinosaurs in them, you don't see a lot of mammals around, because we tend to think of it as the age of reptiles, and mammals, if they existed, were very inconsequential. But there's some articles coming up in our literature which summarizes the stuff that's been coming to light, that there's tremendous numbers of mammals that are being found in dinosaur rocks, but there's not much being done about them. Now, I'm not saying they're deliberately hiding them, but they're not exciting. You know, if you've got a dinosaur display in a museum and you've got these, you know, hundreds of pounds of fossil rock that's got mammal bones in them, then it's, you know, who cares? That's not what I specialised in. I'm a dinosaur expert. And Dr. Carl Werner, who's written some fascinating books and DVDs there on living fossils and so on, he's actually interviewed and spoken to museum guys around the world, and there are hundreds and hundreds of as yet unclassified mammal remains in museums around the world, and the ones that have already been found indicate that there were lots of mammals living alongside the dinosaurs, which is part of the answer to this question: is how can we explain succession in the fossil record? The first thing that has to be established with confidence is how real is that succession, and how much of it is an artifact of the drive to, if you like, and I'm not talking about concocting things, but the drive to classify things according to evolutionary presuppositions. You see, evolutionists often say, well, if a fossil is found out of place, it would falsify evolution, and therefore that's never happened, and therefore it must be right. But in fact, there's been many fossils found that are in the wrong place, but there are mechanisms to deal with that. You extend the range. For example, vertebrates have now been found as far back as in the Precambrian, and that's now accepted. You know, they're very, very minute creatures, but it used to be said that there weren't even chordates. There weren't even chordates in the Cambrian at one stage. Then there were chordates, then there were vertebrates, and they went all the way back to the Precambrian. People say, well, you know, if people and dinosaurs lived together, the fact that you never find them in the same rock as fossils, that means they couldn't have lived on the same earth at the same time. But if you point out that by that reasoning, coelacanths and whales should never have lived on the earth at the same time. This is the coelacanth, a very common fossil found in dinosaur rock. It's interesting that a lot of the dinosaur fossils are accompanied by marine fossils. How come if they're land creatures? They make sense in a flood scenario. Now, you never find whale fossils with those fossils. And to the evolutionist, for years it was obvious. We know that because whales hadn't evolved yet. You know, whales evolved long time later. That's why you don't find them until much higher levels. But in fact, we know today that coelacanths and whales did live on the same earth at the same time, because living coelacanths have turned up. In 1938 already, it was an astonishing thing, because you don't find any coelacanth fossils in the intervening rocks, but you find living coelacanths off Madagascar. And then later, in the 1950s, they found another population close to Indonesia. A scientist was walking through an Indonesian fish shop, and he saw one of them lying there for sale. He got the shock of his life. So what I'm getting at, and for example, we often show when talking about the age of the Earth in a more detailed specialist lecture, we refer to an article in Nature magazine in 1966. It refers to the Roraima formation in South America, which is supposed to be 1.8 billion years old, and in that are the spores and the pollen grains of plants. Now, plants only appeared, according to the evolutionary scenario, more than a billion, well past a billion years younger than that particular thing. And they actually sent a team of four or five scientists there to investigate, to try and find some explanation for this anomaly. And the scientist concerned, who was sort of the local fossil expert, he said, no answer has been found, and this remains an intriguing enigma, or a word like that. So that's the other mechanism of dealing with it, is to just sort of say, well, we'll solve it at some time in the future. Again, I'm not saying that's unreasonable. You've got to understand that that's, from their perspective, that makes a lot of sense. But that's how come that all these impressions build up, that there's this massive amount of evidence. Same thing with radiometric dating. If a radiometric date fits, it's fine. But if it doesn't fit, then there's an assumption made that it's somehow been contaminated, or this has happened, or that has happened. So it becomes like a monolith of thought, that anomalies are very quickly dispatched. And a lot of philosophers of science have talked about that. That's, I've dealt with that one. That one is just a repeat of the other. This is on climate change. Look, we have enough trouble with the past, let alone the present. But, you know, we try to be apolitical and all that, and so we don't have I mean, the sort of models that they're talking about, they have the potential to be shown to be correct or incorrect in the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years. And there's a lot of discussion among scientists about these models, and yet we're told to accept the accuracy of models of Earth history which go back millions and millions of years. In a sense, a biblical understanding of Earth history is relevant to this issue of climate change, because many of the assumptions are made on the basis of past climates, and they're based again upon the assumptions of millions of years, and they don't take into account, for example, what the Ice Age would have done to the Earth. Now, the Bible actually has a fascinating It provides a fascinating mechanism to explain an ice age. You see, an ice age, which is characterized by lots and lots of glaciers, with water locked up from the oceans on the land, and that would have happened shortly after the flood, and it's actually a mystery how you get it. because it's not good enough to turn down the temperature. That will never give you an ice age. That could cause the oceans to freeze over, but that's not an ice age. An ice age is the water out of the oceans up on the land. And for that, you need massive amounts of extra energy. How does the water get up from the oceans, up into the air, and down again as ice and snow today? Through the sun's energy, the sun's heat, evaporating the water. So you need more energy, more heat, not less. At the end of the flood, you've got all this warm water. It's a lot warmer down there than it is, you know, at the surface. And you've had a lot of volcanism and all the rest of it. And if you've got the oceans only about 10 degrees warmer on average than they are today, you would have the built-in makings of an ice age happening, beginning almost immediately. Because as that water evaporates, the ones at the higher and lower latitudes, close to the north and south pole, comes down as snow and ice. And within 200 to 500 years, that'll build up to glacial maximum, and then it'll gradually melt back as the oceans give up their heat and come back into balance. But if you've got a slow change rather than a catastrophic change, that'll never happen. Because if it's warming up slowly, then the glaciers will melt back as quickly as they formed. There's a lot more on that. Again, the Creation Answers book explains that well, also the website. But that's probably... there's a few articles on our website on climate change, environmentalism and so on, but it's not really our baby. What does the Bible say about aliens and UFOs? Directly, nothing. But aliens and UFOs often make even Christians say, well, maybe God created life on other planets. But that brings up some huge problems in the Christian worldview. Because we're told specifically in Scripture, it's very clear that everything is focused upon people on Earth. You know, even the plants and animals are there as our life support system. And we're told that the whole purpose of this is a bride for the Lord Jesus Christ in all eternity. And people say, well, what's that got to do with it? Well, the point is this, that when Adam died, that curse affected all of creation. So it means if there's an alien civilization on the planet Zork, well, the poor old Zorkians, they cop it with the curse, and they had nothing to do with the whole thing. And they are not descendants of Adam, therefore they can't share in salvation. And there's a lot of detail on our website about that. Just type in, did God create on other planets, or words to that effect, and you'll find it. But let me just close that question by saying that some people say, well, maybe Christ went and died for the Adams of the Zorkian race, or the Vulcanite race, or the Klingon race. But if that was the case, then Christ would have multiple brides. And the Bible makes it clear that Christ will not be a bigamist or polygamist. There's only one bride of the Lord Jesus through all eternity, and that's Adam's fallen race. The book Alien Intrusion has some very fascinating things to say based upon the research of secular people looking into this phenomenon. And they now talk much more, not about the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but what they call the interdimensional hypothesis, which means that they don't see these things as coming from other planets at all. They see them as coming from other dimensions. In other words, they see a very spiritual thing. And it's interesting that Gary Bates, my colleague who authored that book, he's now a very well-known speaker on the UFO circuit in Christian circles. And a guy he speaks with was a New Ager, and he became a Christian, and he started to notice this pattern that when people were coming to him with accounts of alien abductions, the only people that seemed not to be getting abducted were what he calls walk-the-walk Christians. And many people have actually reported halting alleged abductions in the name of Jesus. So there's a real obvious spiritual factor there. That's covered. Okay, here we are. If Noah only took pairs of animals on the ark, how would they have enough genetic variation to sustain a minimum viable population? Well, the first thing we need to ask is, do we know how much genetic variation is required to sustain a viable population? And really, that hasn't been established yet. In fact, many things that were once believed to be non-viable, minimum variation, has been found not to be the case. There are certain types of mammals thriving on islands where they were released by people, and they're almost identical in their DNA, and they're doing very, very well. Cheetahs, for example, are not far off of being clones of each other, and their populations are quite viable and have been for a very long time. The other thing you've got to remember is that as a mongrel dog population through human selection is broken down into subpopulations such as Chihuahuas, Great Danes and so on, each of these new varieties carries less information than the parents. And that's fairly obvious because the breeding crowds the genes for one type of characteristic like smallness and cuteness into that one population, and in the process it has to crowd out the genes for some of the other characteristics. To put it very simply, your common sense will agree with this: if I was to wipe out every dog in the world except Chihuahuas, and I started with the Chihuahuas, I could never breed a Great Dane again, because I've lost some of those genes for that Great Daneness, if you like. I'd have to go back to the original dog kind. Chengsha Feng is a plant scientist who's done a lot of work with Creation Ministries from Western Australia, with the Western Australian government, and he described how the lupin crop of Western Australia was nearly wiped out by one particular fungus, because what they'd done, they'd bred and selected till they had this super lupin crop. And of course, when you select for one factor, you're crowding out the genes for something else. And all the lupins in Western Australia that were planted by the government or through government agencies were the type that were susceptible to this fungus. In order to save the lupins, they had to go back to the wild lupin and find genes and breed them back into the population that were resistant to this fungus. So take that process backwards. You combine, go back in time, you combine the dog breeds into the mongrel dog. The mongrel dog populations themselves arose from previous populations which, as you go back in time, get ever closer to the wolf. The wolf itself can interbreed with coyotes and dingoes, the Asiatic wild dog, and so Noah would have only taken a pair of a dog kind. How much variation did that have? We'd have to guess. But can you see, as you go back in time to before the flood, you have populations with much more natural variability. I think we're heading towards the end here. How's our time going, Pastor? Probably. Okay, I'll see if I can. That's climate change. We've done that. We've done that one. What about carbon dating? That's a very, very lengthy one. I think perhaps our time is running a bit low. I'm not ducking away from that one. I love talking about it, but it's a longer talk than the dinosaurs. Let me very, very briefly say that I was at a small Anglican church in Pakenham in Victoria, and I didn't know beforehand that the minister was going to say this. He said, I used to be an exploration geologist. He said, one of my jobs was to find samples for the mining companies for radiometric dating. And he said most of the time they'd send me back to get another one because it wasn't good enough. He said one day I asked them, what's wrong with it? And they said, wrong date. And it suddenly hit him. How would they know it's the wrong date unless they've got an idea in their mind of what the date is supposed to be? So you've got, again, this shaping issue. Professor Richard Morgan, evolutionist, in 77, he wrote in the Journal of Geology, he wrote that dates that are in the correct ballpark are published, and dates that are, not what you expect, they seldom get mentioned, nor are discrepancies fully explained. People don't realize that radiometric dating does not give you a measure of age. There's no such thing as age that you can measure. It's a calculated age. I'm just going to show you very, very quickly two, from a radiocarbon dating lab, forms. We actually sent several specimens for radiocarbon dating because we love to carbon date things that are supposed to be millions of years old because they're not supposed to have any carbon in them, because it's supposed to have decayed away, this radioactive carbon, in far less than 100,000 years. But every time you date something like coal or oil or gas or, you know, fossilized bits of tree that have still got some organic carbon in them, they have radioactive carbon in them, and they're not supposed to have. And they try to explain that away with contamination, but they do all sorts of things to try and overcome this contamination. And here's something I've whited out. This is the from a radiometric dating laboratory where we sent specimens to have them dated. And they ask you these questions. Collection date, when did you get it? That's fair enough. Sample mass, how much did you send us? Fair enough. Look at this question, anticipated age. Why would they need to know that? It's like asking, you know, what age do you want? I mean, if you went to your doctor and you asked for your blood pressure to be measured, you would not be impressed if he said, well, what pressure will please you, you know? I showed this once in New Zealand, and a man put up his hand. And he said, I'm from the Waikato Radiocarbon Dating Laboratory. And I thought, whoa, what's he going to say? And he said, I'll send you our form. You'll like it even better. And he was right. It says, nature of investigation, how was sample collection and treated, blah, blah. And he said, look, estimate age. What age do you want? Age limits from what's the lowest you'll accept to what's the highest you'll accept. Basis of estimate. Tell us why you'll accept it. I mean, I'm not, there's a lot more I could say now. I'm not ridiculing them. I don't think it's any sort of conscious deception. It's because if the age is way out, they want a chance to recalculate. But that just shows you how flexible these things are. And when you actually date specimens that are known to be just decades old, they too give you dates in the millions of years. So there's some real issues with the whole radiometric dating. And in fact, it's probable that the issue has been solved. If you go to our website and you type in the search engine the word RATE, R-A-T-E, you will find some fascinating articles. That stands for Radioactive Isotopes and the Age of the Earth, which was a joint research project by several creationist organizations. And we think there's probably an answer there as to why you get millions and billions of years. I think I've probably gone long enough. What do you reckon? Thank you very much for your patience. And if you've got some burning questions, come and see me.